Welcome to the Bumblecast, everyone. I am your host, Ian Flynn, the Bumble King, and joining me as always is the blue Joy-Con to my red Joy-Con, Kyle Krause.
I am a Joy-Con. I am a joystick controller.
Well, you are a very snappy individual.
Ho, 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 ho. Well, I'm not ready to make the switch quite yet.
Ah, well played, sir. Well played.
You're welcome.
So what have you been up to?
Well, there's been a lot going on in the world lately. I still managed to find the time here and there to listen to some good music.
Excellent.
And I discovered something, a really cool artist this week that I'm really enjoying the work of. An artist named Meteor, who is a synthwave composer from Colombia. And you can find their music at meteormusic.bandcamp.com. And the stuff they've done is excellent. It's, you know, 80s movie soundtrack inspired stuff. Think things like Transformers the movie, kind of. Rocky IV. Kung Fury, even though that's not an 80s movie.
It's
obviously insane. It is very much an 80s inspired movie. You know, with everything cranked up to 11, kind of a parody. But the music is excellent. So, you know, Mitch Murder, who's a composer for Kung Fury. It's kind of in that style. Or I guess if you want to go video games, maybe Hotline Miami. Or Far Cry 3 Blood Dragon.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that very much that kind of sound and aesthetic. It's great. So I highly recommend you check it out. Meteormusic.bandcamp.com is where you can find them. It's got not only does it have that great synthwave sound to it, it also has a lot of awesome guitars. So go be sure to head on over there and check out his album Parallel Lives, especially the tracks Destroyer and Hunter of Lost Souls, because those are great. So go grab those. So what have you been up to, Ian?
Well, one of the many secret projects I've teased over on Twitter for a while has finally been announced.
Woo-hoo!
I'm doing Uncanny Valley High, which is a comic book for Space Goat Publishing. It is a high school setting. If the high school was in the Matrix and the Matrix was running on the beta version of its software.
So it's glitching out a little bit all the time.
Yeah, it's
very nice.
It's chock full of game and coding in jokes. It's just a really, really nerdy book.
Yes.
Also, the latest in the Tales of RPG series, Tales of Berseria, just came out.
Mm-hmm.
Ali and I have been devouring that game, which, come to think of it, is actually a bit of a pun given the themes. But the fun thing about Berseria is it's a prequel to the last major game, Tales of Zestiria.
Oh, really?
And in Zestiria, the main character is an archaeology nerd. And part of his personal quest is delving into the gods and the history of the world and, you know, how mistakes of the past continue to haunt the present and how you can correct that. And really interestingly was that at the very end, in the final dungeon, they come across the crest of this god that he had never heard of before. Who the heck is a Numenut? The oldest of texts, the oldest of the oldest, barely reference it. What in the world? Berseria takes place, I can't tell how many hundreds of years before, but addresses Enomenot and pretty much all the things that were kind of these fringe mysteries in the first game. And, you know, you find towns that are just now being founded that are major cities in Zestiria. Major themes between characters and gods that are established by Zestiria are just now being put into motion in Berseria. And it's really neat how they played with it all.
Huh. That's kind of interesting. Kind of reminds me of the way they played with some of the differences between Tales of Symphonia and Fantasia.
Yeah, it's a lot like that.
Yeah. Well, that's really neat. I still haven't played either of them. Maybe I should get on that one of these days. They're RPGs, though, and I tend to be like, oh, I don't really want to sit down and invest 80 hours into a game. Unless it's a game like American Truck Simulator. oh, well, I'm just weird. I should play it, though.
That, and if folks who are listening have played Zestiria and went, you know, the camera in that game was really, really bad.
Uh-huh.
As in, some of the battles were unplayable because the camera would get stuck in doorways or walls or inside of enemy units.
I definitely heard and saw some of that.
You'll be happy to know that Berseria fixed that entirely.
Well, that's good.
Because Zestiria tried to do something new where instead of when you engage in a battle, it goes to a separate, you know, battle arena and, you know, loads that and then loads you back onto the world map. It tried to do it so that when you got caught in an encounter, it was actually wherever you were on the map, kind of Chrono Trigger style.
Huh, yeah.
Except it doesn't quite work in 3D, or if it could work, they didn't make it work. So Berseria goes back to the tried and true, you go into a themed battle area.
Ah, okay. Well, you know, experimentation. You know, you gotta try it. Yeah. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, well, then you... then you go back. Or you just keep trying until it does work, or things go horribly, horribly wrong, and then, well, I don't know. I don't know where I'm going with this.
And the cast is delightful, and they tempt you with... one of the features of the Tales of series as of late are skits, where some of them are story-oriented, some of them are just kind of fun side things where the characters bicker or interact. And they originally were done in just little profile shots, but with Berseria, it's almost become light puppetry, because you have full body shots that are slightly animated, you've got eyes moving around, it isn't just static images. And to promote the weekly DLC, they have for free downloads of exclusive skits that are themed to each bit of DLC. Which, if you think about the amount of production cost and time that goes into that,
yeah,
I'm rather tickled by it. And just, it's a great game. We've been enjoying it a lot. And we're going to be spending a lot of time this show talking about video games and my personal impressions of them. So before we move on to the main topic, we're going to take a slight detour and do the Bumble Raffle.
Yeah, you're going to win a comic book, somebody. Who could it be?
It could be any one of our patrons over at patreon.com/bumblecast. They get entered into every single drawing for every single show automatically. Or it could be anybody else who writes in. Now, you have to write in for each individual show if you're not a patron, but you get the same chances as everybody else. So, this week's Bumble Raffle winner is...
A new winner!
S. Yavada Bitch 9X. Yavada Yadzavarva? Something like that.
We always have fun with his name.
Yes, yes. You win!
We'll get in touch with you, and you tell us how to send the book to you. And if you really are named S. Yavadovich 9X, please spell it out, because heaven knows we're not going to be able to guess that one.
Well, I mean, his name is there on the patron list. Okay, let's ignore that.
Quiet, you!
Okay.
For no reason.
Oh, well, sorry about that.
Logic.
Sorry about that.
So, good friends over at Nightworks.com got me early access to a Nintendo Switch preview event, which was originally meant only for the press, but I got connections, you know? So I got to go in and see the stuff firsthand. And it was a really nice setup. Like, it was kind of like a very miniature E3 where very big standees, lots of props. The Mario Kart 8 Deluxe set had a mock airplane setting for you to play on, a diner setting, and a big presentation screen in the middle of it all.
Well, Nintendo probably did pay for all that stuff for, like, E3 or some other big event, so they might as well use it.
Exactly. And if you go over to my Twitter, at IanFlynnBKC, you can see a ton of screen photos I took from the show. You can see Night Train of Nightworks hitting me with a Mario Kart, me riding on a Splatoon squid, all sorts of good stuff.
Nice.
And folks who follow the patron, excuse me, folks who follow the Patreon know that we've been having my reviews of the games every day for the past week, leading up to this episode where we cover my hardware experiences. So we'll get to games in minutes, but let's talk about hardware. Let's talk about the Switch itself. Now, to be clear, the Switch is the portable screen device thingy. That is the Switch.
Okay.
The dock is the little bracket thingy that the Switch plugs into, and that's how it displays to the TV.
Yes.
And then the Joy-Cons are the itty-bitty microcontrollers that snap onto the sides of the Switch itself if you want to use it like the Wii U gamepad.
Uh-huh.
And if the thing that the Joy-Cons hook into to make it into a regular controller has a name, I don't know that off the top of my head. And then, of course, there's the Pro Controller, which looks like any regular video game controller.
I think the thing the Joy-Cons slip into is the grip. That's what it's okay. What Nintendo calls it.
So we'll just use that for the sake of the show.
Okay.
I unfortunately did not get experience with the grip. I really wanted to, but I just didn't get a chance. Because most of the games were played either with the Switch itself or with the Pro Controller.
Mm-hmm.
Which to me is kind of telling, but we'll get into that in a bit. The Pro Controller. Let's start off with the best. That was fantastic.
Is it $70 nice fantastic?
Hmm?
Is it $70 fantastic?
Almost. Almost.
I'm sure it's well built. I mean, Nintendo.
Yeah, oh yeah, it feels solid. It's very comfortable in the hands. It's got a nice weight to it. It's not too light. It's not too heavy. Mm-hmm. The button placement all feels natural. The control sticks feel responsive. It's just, it's a nice control. It feels really good.
Now, is it in the Xbox style configuration with the offset sticks? Okay, that's right. Yeah.
So it coincides with how the Joy-Cons would fit if it were attached to the grip.
Ah, right.
Okay. Now, I'm assuming that because of that, the grip would be about the same as the Pro Controller, so I'm going to give that the benefit of the doubt.
A similar feel, yeah, probably.
Got to play a number of things with the Joy-Cons by themselves, because these things are packed with stuff.
Yeah, that's what I hear.
And it's got the four face buttons, the analog stick, two shoulder buttons, the advanced gyroscope controls, they call it HD rumble because you're supposed to be able to feel like individual marbles within it for some of the games. It's maybe a little too much for me, but my chief concern going in was that the Joy-Cons by themselves, you know, used sideways like the Wiimote, would be uncomfortable because they're so tiny.
Mm-hmm.
They're like tortilla chips. A bag of Tostitos are bigger than those things. They fit in the palm of your hand.
Uh-huh.
And especially the right-hand one, because the stick is so offset, I felt like you'd be reaching too far to use it. And I'm very happy to say that both of those were very comfortable to use.
Well, that's good.
Like, I was surprised how comfortable. I feel like I'm going to lose it in the couch cushion really easily, but other than that...
Sure.
It was responsive. The gyroscopes felt really, really tight. Like, anytime you needed it for motion control, it felt dead on.
Mm-hmm.
The Wii U era stuff always had that slight delay, that kind of floatiness to it, I suppose, even with the enhancement that the Wiimote got for Skyward Sword. And these feel like a distinct step forward. So the Joy-Cons themselves, really impressive.
Nice.
And Nintendo knows exactly what they're doing, because you can get the one Switch with a red and a blue one, and then you can buy the opposite red and blue separately so that you can have an all blue or all red controller, because OCD demands that it not be one or the other.
Well, I guess in Japan there is a website. Nintendo has a website where you can special order a Switch in whatever color configuration you want.
Ooh.
Including, I think, a color configuration that isn't available here, which would be black. I don't think the Joy-Cons come in straight black, or at least not yet. So, but that's apparently Japan exclusive, which is kind of lame, Nintendo.
There's also a series of character-themed ones. I'm not sure where they're being released or when.
Probably only in Japan, because Japan only gets all the cool stuff.
Which, if that's the case, it's going to hurt, because there's two Splatoon-themed ones.
Uh-huh.
There's a purple and green for Callie and Marie, and there's blue and orange for the Inkling kids.
Hmm.
In addition to a Mario Luigi, a Peach and Daisy, Wario Waluigi, Bowser Bowser Jr., and Donkey Kong Diddy Kong. Oh, and Toad and Yoshi, but who cares about them?
Oh, come on. Don't hate on Yoshi. Notice I didn't say anything about Toad. Oh, I kind of like Toad, too. It's okay. Captain Toad. Anyway.
Now, the Switch as a controller, like the Wii U pad.
Uh-huh.
Really bad experience there.
You don't like it?
Really don't like it.
For is one it thing, too far it apart? Feels,
the spacing is about the same as the Wii U pad. That's not the problem.
Okay.
The Wii U pad has a nice weight to it.
Uh-huh.
It's not too heavy. It's not too light. And to me, it feels like a very solid piece of plastic.
Hmm.
Switch, to me, feels a little too heavy and a little too flimsy. Like I'm going to be able to break it in half. And when I was playing Mario Kart 8 Deluxe in the diner setting that they had set up, so I had the ability to comfortably rest my elbows on a table.
Yeah.
My wrists were screaming within 3 minutes.
Ooh.
Now, that might be in part because of the security lock they had attached to it, but I don't think that was most of it. I don't think it felt very good overall.
Huh.
Which is really disappointing.
Yeah, especially since they're positioning it as a portable console that you can use at home instead of the other way around. That's really strange. I can understand why it's heavy because, I mean, it is practically the entire console.
Yeah.
But
that's exactly what it is.
But it seems it seems like they'd make it a little bit more reasonably balanced weight-wise. So that's really strange to me.
Now, that said, the Joy-Cons attaching to either side had a very satisfying click. That's not just ad campaign fluff. That's how it really is. It just snaps right in there. And they felt very secure.
Okay.
And what was very nice was when I was playing Breath of the Wild, you know, I started off on the Pro Controller. The guy running the demo said, all right, we're going to switch over to the handheld version of the Switch. And it popped right out of the dock, no problem.
Mm-hmm.
Went straight into the game. And then when I said, you know what, this sucks, we're going back to the Pro Controller, snapped right back into the dock and was immediately back on the TV. No delay, no flipping switches or whatever. It was almost seamless.
Sweet. Could you use the Pro Controller with it out of the dock? Did you try that?
No, I did not. Specifically because that's how they were directing the demo.
Okay.
I wouldn't imagine you could, because it feels like that once it pops out of the dock, it automatically goes to I'm in mobile mode now.
Hmm.
Because once I slipped it back in the dock, it prompted me to turn on the Pro Controller.
Yeah, well, that the initial release trailer did show that you could still pull the Joy-Cons off when you're in mobile mode with it. So I was just kind of wondering if maybe you could still use the Pro Controller with it, which, yeah, I don't know, maybe you could, maybe not, but it seems like that nice flexibility would be nice.
I mean, for the sake of the demo, they probably wanted to streamline it.
Right.
I only had 90 minutes with Breath of the Wild, so there wasn't a lot of time to juggle controllers and see what went where, so
yeah,
probably you can. I'm sure you can, but...
Obviously, it's just, you can't necessarily do everything or account for everything just because of the way they're probably organizing the event or shuffling people around or, you know, just whatever, maybe to think about it, whatever. But so
now, in terms of, you know, the higher end tech stuff, frames per minute and polygons and I don't care personally. Mm-hmm. I'm of the mind that if it looks nice, if it runs smoothly, I don't care if it's 30 frames per second or 60 frames per second. I don't care how many P's you have on your television. As long as I'm able to enjoy the gaming experience without any distractions, I'm good. And in that regard, it was fantastic. I mean, whether it was on the television or on the Switch's screen, it was crisp. It was clear. I didn't notice any slowdown. Everything moved very, very smoothly. Can't really judge sound because there were 5 million things going on at once.
Right.
But visually, at least, I found it very pleasing, both docked and as a handheld.
Did you notice any graphical fidelity loss between pulling it out when it's docked versus undocked?
Absolutely not. It looked like going from a big TV to a little TV.
Okay. Well, the resolution is going to be slightly different. I hear that they're also underclocking the graphics processor when it's undocked, which apparently causes some of the effects, some of the more subtle lighting effects and stuff to be turned off in Breath of the Wild. But apparently it's almost entirely unnoticeable unless you know what you're looking for, so...
Yeah, and the screen is so much smaller.
That too, that
I don't think you could really notice it unless you are doing a video capture off it to scrutinize it, in which case you're not playing off the screen anyway.
Right. Exactly. You know? Yeah. And that's fine to me. To me, that sounds perfectly fine for something that's intended to be both taken on the go and used at home. I mean, graphical fidelity, we've gotten to a point where we're hitting the wall of diminishing returns.
Right.
So if you, yeah, just look at what happened, the difference between the PS4 and the PS4 Pro, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not that much of a difference between the two. So we're getting to a point where graphical fidelity just isn't making those leaps and bounds like it was early in the video game space.
And I'm all for very pretty games. I can appreciate what can be done.
Absolutely, I mean, yeah.
Shoot, have you seen the stuff they've done in Uncharted 4?
Yeah,
it's jaw-dropping.
Yeah, it's great. And the fact that it's on console even, which is even more amazing.
But I want gameplay first,
right?
Graphics second.
Yes.
You know, razzle-dazzle me all you want. If it's not fun to play, then what's the point?
Yeah.
Unless it's one of those kind of interactive movies, in which case, sorry, make it all razzly-dazzly, I'll just kind of ride along.
Yeah.
But just let me know what I'm in for.
Give me a good art style. That's what I want. That's what I really want. The art style to me is more important than outright graphical fidelity. I mean, something that looks good. I just want it to look good. And you can make anything look good on pretty much anything. So, I mean, there's tons of NES games that look absolutely gorgeous, so... Don't tell me that you can't make something look good on something old or something less powerful, because I'm sure now, the Switch will have plenty of beautiful games.
In terms of the local Wi-Fi multiplayer,
uh-huh.
Played Mario Kart 8 Deluxe in their new battle mode and did Splatoon 2. And you couldn't tell me that it wasn't a direct landline. They played silky smooth. Didn't notice any kind of ghosting or lag or anything like that. It felt like it was just local multiplayer.
Yeah, Nintendo's had a long time to work that out. That's been around since the DS, and they did really well with the wireless technology on the Wii U as far as using the gamepad screen, because the gamepad tends to have less lag than most TVs. Which is hilarious. So, yeah, I'm not surprised there. But that's good, though.
So, overall, hardware-wise, it's a nice console. If you're looking in terms of raw power, it's not going to hold up to, you know, the One or the PS4 or any of their versions. But Nintendo really hasn't ever been about the power. It's about the library.
Mm.
So, if they've got a solid library for this thing... It should be just fine. I don't know if their whole take your home console on the go is going to fly, but I don't know. There's no way I can really make a prediction of where the company's going to go with it. From my firsthand experience, I know that the demos that I played were fun for the most part. And in terms of here is the new Nintendo thing with the new games, I enjoyed that much.
Cool.
I am going to miss the Wii U pad, though. I really like that addition.
Yeah, yeah. I like the Wii U a lot, actually. It'll be sad to kind of give up that gamepad because it's really nicely balanced. So, but yeah, that's great. That's I'm glad you enjoyed it. Do you, after actually playing with the hardware, do you have any of the trepidation that we had on the last episode when we talked about the Switch? Kind of that thought of is there still a question of success with this thing, or do you think it'll be okay?
It honestly hasn't answered any of my questions. If anything, the portable version of the Switch makes me really nervous.
Yeah.
I'm hoping I'm the odd one out, because Aaliyah was saying that when she used it, she didn't feel any of the things I did with it. She felt comfortable with it.
Okay.
And the fact that I had such a negative response to it makes me wonder if, I don't know, my arms are broken or something. But
do you have a history of issues with that?
Not especially. I mean, I don't remember having issues with the Wii U pad.
Do you have a carpal tunnel from all that Sonic comic writing you've been doing? I hope not. But if you do, I mean, well, maybe that's something to do with it.
Well, if you want to talk about reactions to controllers and Sonic the Hedgehog, I did get to play Sonic Mania again.
Ah, yes, I saw that.
And that's just getting back on the old horse. God, man. It's perfect.
Yes.
It's perfect. Well, it feels like a Genesis game.
Oh, man. Yes.
It doesn't feel like we're trying to make a Genesis game. It feels like a Genesis game.
I'm so glad to hear that. I mean, no, there was no doubt in my mind that it was going to be, you know, it's Christian Whitehead using his engine, the same engine that he's used for all those mobile remakes of the older Sonic games. So I was like, yeah, it's going to feel pretty much identical to a classic Sonic game, and I'm really happy to hear that.
This was still the old demo build with Green Hill Zone and Studiopolis, so
right,
nothing really new to report. But the levels just are so much fun to play.
Mm-hmm.
You just jump right in there, and you get your Sonic on, and oh, it's good.
Oh yes, I'm so glad. I'm so very happy. I'm looking forward to that game a lot.
The other one, the one that I was just clawing at the door to get to, was Breath of the Wild.
Mm-hmm.
We walked in the door, and I made a beeline straight to that demo station. I was the first one to sit down and play, and it did not disappoint. I don't know if the intro is going to be exactly the same from demo to actual release, but it basically was, here's your gear if you want it. Here's the world. We'd really like you to go that way, but knock yourself out, champ.
Sounds like Zelda 1.
Yeah, it really is. It's dangerous to go alone. Take this. Link, come back. Link, would you like? All right, fine. Take that tree branch. Knock yourself out, kid.
Have fun. Don't die out there. Oh, you're already dead.
I mean, I've watched probably a grand total of an hour and a half of preview stuff on just the opening plateau area.
Yeah.
And I managed to find something new.
Mm-hmm.
I was running around. There was this rocky stand out in the middle of the forest. There was a rock sitting on top of it. And I thought, oh, I'll just throw that and grab the rupee that'll pop out because it's Zelda.
Yeah.
I climbed up, picked up the rock, and I'm not going to spoil it for anybody who's trying to be super spoiler free, but a creature popped out that I was not anticipating, name dropped something that I'm assuming is going to be a long-term subquest, and gave me a collectible item. And I'm okay. Like, oh, I hope I remember where you are when I get the real game, because I'm not sure how I found you.
Nice. Very nice.
There was this salt plain that I came across, and there was a very distinct natural ramp up to a platform that had a couple of treasure chests just sitting there, asking to be opened. And I go running up the ramp and stop right at the edge going, you know what? I'm not going to make that jump. And that bubbling, sulfurous pit of mud all around does not look friendly. You know what? This is probably a puzzle. I'm not supposed to be here yet.
Uh-oh.
Okay. And just all the different things you can do just from the get-go. I mean, there's obviously direction to it. There are point markers. There's 100 different stamps you can put on your map to say, go back here, stupid. Because, oh, you can get lost really fast. But it's pretty, the diversity of what you can do and where you can go and what you can experience in just the first 20 minutes is staggering.
Yeah.
And reports of the map size are just mind-boggling. So I cannot wait to get on this. The one complaint I have is that the button mapping did not feel intuitive. I had a lot of, okay, I want to pull out my weapon. I just put my weapon away. I want to jump backwards. Actually, I just rolled into the guy. But I'm hoping you can remap the buttons, and if not, it's just a matter of getting used to the control scheme. But other than that, it was responsive when I was hitting what I meant to hit.
Yeah.
The fighting was engaging. I mean, and it's not easy. This is not a hand-holdy Zelda. It will kill you very quickly and mercilessly. Very simple starter mobs will go for the throat, and that's it. You lose.
Yeesh. Well, I'm looking forward to trying it out at some point.
And the last one I wanted to highlight out of all the ones I reviewed was ARMS.
Ah, yes.
They, part of what they debuted, I think it was like the first thing they showed off at the Switch announcement.
Pretty close to it, yeah. If I believe you were correct.
And at first blush, I didn't care about it because it looked like a gimmicky Wii boxing thing.
Uh-huh.
And having played it firsthand, I got to say, it's a lot better than I thought it was going to be.
Well, good. Because it looks cool.
If the controls work out, like if the multiplayer is robust enough, if the single player is not cheap, I could see this becoming like the next Splatoon. It looks like a potentially solid Nintendo first-party IP. Because you've got your cartoony, iconic cast of characters, you've got a different style of gameplay, but it's easy to get into, and it was actually skill-based. It wasn't just, you know, flail and pray and maybe you hit. There was a degree of tactical assessment in the fighting.
Yeah.
So I'm really hoping that it works out, but it's one of those games where if the AI is not tuned with human interaction in mind, it's going to be a nightmare to play.
Mm-hmm.
Because judging where your fists are going as you fling them across the screen and trying to aim with them takes a lot of practice, but it is somewhat at the mercy of the gyroscope controls. And a computer is, if they don't do it right, is going to know exactly how to throw its own punches, and it's going to be impossible.
Yeah.
And that'll just suck the fun right out of the game.
I have heard that there is an option to play it with, you know, standard style button controls rather than motion controls. Did you get a chance to try those? Okay. Yeah, that's what I'd heard, is you could still play it the old-fashioned way if you really wanted to.
Well, then that would take away all my concerns right there.
Yeah, well, there you go. I mean, it still might be fun to play it that way.
It really was fun to get into it. Mm-hmm. Like, did you ever play the Wii Sports Boxing?
Yes, it was horrible.
And exhausting. That's the key thing.
That too, yes, very much so.
Not so with ARMS. ARMS actually felt less like physical exertion and more like actual playing a game.
More intuitive.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that is, you know, you're actually gauging your input instead of just going,
right. Yeah. Punch-Out for the Wii has a motion control setup where you use both the Wii Remote, the Nunchuck, Wii Remote and Nunchuck, and the balance board.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually works surprisingly well. That's not the ideal way to play it, by any stretch of the imagination, but it actually works and is pretty fun. So I can see them sort of applying that idea to this to the new game. So I'm looking forward to trying that one too. That one looks really cool. How was Splatoon 2?
Splatoon 2 feels like the exact right kind of sequel.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't try to reinvent the series. It doesn't go, oh, Splatoon was great, let's make it better and then ruin it. It feels like, here's Splatoon with some new stuff. That's all you need. And that's what they gave you.
Well, couldn't they have just patched that into the original? I mean, this had to be, to be fair, it's on a new console and it's not backwards compatible. It's still, you know.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of new cosmetic stuff, new hairstyles, new clothing options, new weapons and stuff.
Right.
The new weapon that they were really showing off was the Twin Dualies, which are a pair of repeater pistols.
Mm-hmm.
And those were fun. Nice spread, nice range, a decent amount of coverage for your ink tank. But to me, the key to those Twin Dualies was the roll dodge that it gives you.
Ah.
No other weapon has the roll dodge.
Hmm.
That roll dodge is a game changer. Because Splatoon, it's got a decent running speed, but it feels a little plodding.
Yeah, I guess compared to a lot of
other shooters.
I agree.
That roll dodge is lightning fast.
Very nice.
That is a move from here to there. Oh no, you're not tracking me. Boom, you're dead.
But it's a Splatoon Dark Souls? Just rolling everywhere?
Yeah. It really could be. It takes a little getting used to, but oh, when people start really getting a handle on it, it's going to be a nightmare to fight against.
Actually, you know, since it's dual pistols with rolling around, it's like some real, you know, parkour stuff.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, overall, it was just good old fashioned Splatoon goodness.
The one thing I'm curious about is the super jump. How do they handle that without having a separate touchscreen?
Okay, I forget what the actual button input is, but it pulls up a mini map, or I should say, it pulls up a map over your screen.
Uh-huh.
And then each of your teammates is assigned a direction on the D-pad.
Okay.
So it's like the Wii U screen. It's very easy to say, okay, there's the person I'm jumping to. Boom, go. And you can pull up the map at any point. So it is also kind of like the Wii U screen. So you can still use it for that kind of tactical edge.
Uh-huh.
But it does, you know, take up the full screen. You can't just glance down and back up.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit of a liability. It snaps up and down fast enough that you could argue it's the same as looking up at one screen and down at the other and back again.
Sure.
So it'll take some actual gameplay to see whether or not it makes that big of a difference. But to me, it felt very responsive, and it felt like an acceptable placeholder for the old Wii U option.
So a good compromise then. That's what I was mostly concerned about, was just like, how are they going to do that?
Now, I'm not sure how they would still do beacons. That may be out the window.
Yeah, they might have, unless they've come up with something new. Maybe beacons have different button combinations assigned to them or something. That would be kind of a pain, but something like that, maybe. Or
I
maybe,
honestly don't know.
Or maybe they just decided that they were looking at the data of how many people actually use beacons, and they decided they just weren't worth keeping around. I don't know. So that's interesting. I'm looking forward to giving that one a shot, too, one of these days. Got anything else? Any other impressions on the Switch before we move on?
I will say that I had fun overall.
Mm-hmm.
The controllers, for the most part, felt solid. I'm still wary at the price point.
Yeah.
I'm not super bedazzled by the game library.
Mm-hmm.
But Breath of the Wild is something that I want desperately. And I'm really hoping that they'll put a lot of first-party support behind it. So, cautiously optimistic?
Well, they will put a lot of first-party support behind it. The question is, are they going to have some third-party support to back that up a bit?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, and it's... There's a lot of third parties that are claiming they're doing stuff with this Switch, but it still looks like some pretty slim pickings from them, at least for the initial launch window and going into fall. It's kind of like they're just re-releasing old games or porting stuff, and it's like, that's fine, but we need something new. So I'm a little worried about that, but either way, I'm still looking forward to it. I'm sure I'll be able to test it out once it hits the Best Buy store kiosk or something like that around here.
Mm.
which might be in just another week or two, actually, since we're coming up on the launch of the thing already.
Yep.
Wow. Seems like just yesterday we were calling it the NX.
I still like that better than the Switch.
I do. I do, too. It's not.
I usually like the prototype names better than the official ones anyway.
Well, yeah, we could have called the GameCube the Dolphin.
Yeah, I'll go with GameCube.
Oh, you don't like Echo?
No, not really.
That's a shame. Echo doesn't like you either.
That's fine.
Okay.
Echo can stay in the water and the machine all at once.
Okay. All right, let's go ahead and get into some Patreon Q&A, priority Q&A, and some regular Q&A. We're gonna do all the Q&A, okay? All of it.
Okay.
Well, actually, only six of it, but that, yeah, you know what I mean.
All the Q&A for this show.
Yes, yes. If you have a question that you're dying for us to answer, email us at bumblecast@yahoo.com. Hit us up on Twitter using the hashtag bumblecast, at KyleJCRB or at IanFlynnBKC. Or leave a comment or send us a message via Patreon for our Patreon supporters. This first question from the priority Q&A list comes from Sam Cybercat.
Howdy, Sam.
Hi again, Sam. Play it again. I don't think that's actually a real quote from that movie. Anyway, this question has probably been asked before, but as it's been a while and there's been more comics since, which of the characters introduced since the reboot have you found that fans have had the biggest reactions to?
Top four would be Eclipse, the Darkling, who, I've said it before, I'll say it again, if we did him wrong, it would have been very wrong. But we managed to do him right, and people seem to respond to that. Folks greatly enjoy Relic. I think they really latched onto her dynamic with Knuckles, which is great.
Relic is my favorite one, I think.
Razor has been a kind of a surprise standout. It's part of the reason why he has gotten a little bit more focused than the rest of the Moropus crew is because of just the sheer amount of fan following. And Princess Udina seems to be a big hit, which that I'm not too surprised about because we knew we were working with gold with her anyway.
Yeah, she's great too. I do like her. Were there any others that may have been a kind of a surprising standout other than Razor?
Not really stand out. I think a lot of people are cautiously interested.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the new version of Dulcie and her team, the Desert Raiders, and Egg Boss Thunderbolt.
Ah, yes.
Of all the Egg Bosses.
Yeah.
She has been put on the highest of pedestals.
She's great.
Ma comes in a close second, but
yeah,
nobody can really touch Thunderbolt.
Yeah. I do like Opal. From the
out of all the pirates, she seems to have been the biggest hit.
Yeah,
and with Captain Shellbreaker, you either love his speech impediment or you absolutely hate it. You think it's the funniest thing ever, or you think it's derivative and dumb. And that's exactly what I was going for.
I think it's great, but I'm just weird.
It's one of those dumb jokes that loops right back around to being funny again. You can't help it.
Yeah, exactly. All right, next question comes from Fancy Fool.
Hey there, Fancy Fool. Welcome back.
Ian, why are you having Amy and Cream go on an adventure with Sally in Sonic Universe 97 when Amy has already had ample interactions with Sally and Cream and has interacted almost exclusively with Sally since the Shattered World Crisis? Why not have them adventure with the Freedom Fighters they rarely interact with or haven't even talked to, like Bunny, Antoine, or Rotor?
Well, I wouldn't say exclusive, given that she's, you know, not done that.
Yeah.
But with the Freedom Fighter arc, it's not just... All right, let's try this another approach. The Freedom Fighter arc, to even get that remotely possible, we have a Sega character on the cover, front and center, with each part.
Right.
You know, the Antoine story... has Sonic. Here is Sonic. Look at Sonic. come for the Antoine. Well, come for the Sonic, stay for the Antoine.
Mm-hmm.
The Bunny Story. There's Blaze. See Blaze? Come for the Blaze. Stay for the Bunny Story.
Well, I came for the Bunny, but that's okay.
Well, yeah. That, see, well, fans of the comic are going to come for that, but they are not the main driving force. They are a solid foundation, sure.
Right.
But they're not the end-all, be-all source. You have to pull in the casual game fans.
And actually, I really like both Blaze and Bunny a lot. So I came for both of them. So, yes. But anyway, I don't matter.
For the Sally story, the problem there is, unfortunately, and I really hate that this is true, the female-centric issues are harder to sell, which is extremely frustrating because we have a fantastic female cast, and I hate the sexism that's in that. And I really hope that people will just pick up the book for completion's sake and read it and see that they are strong characters and stay for it. But
and those are the ones that all end up being my personal favorite arcs. So
I know, for
universe wise. So
we're already fighting an uphill battle there.
Right.
Amy is an extremely polarizing character, but she has the star power.
Yeah.
And Sally, out of all the freedom fighters, is perhaps the most recognizable within the casual market.
Yeah.
So it was a concentrated marketing effort to tell a Sally story and capitalize on her presence and Amy's presence to bring in as many readers as possible to offset the inevitable loss in readership because it's a quote-unquote girl book. Blaze gets around that because Blaze has kind of clawed her way in that small niche of boys going, okay, she has fire powers, she's cool. And it, I want to beat my head against the wall because I hate it, but
yeah,
that's where we are right now.
Yeah.
And with these stories of strong female characters, I hope that we can fight against that tide. But you got to work with what the world gives you.
Mm-hmm.
And I really want to accentuate the Amy Cream dynamic. I like them as a duo, and I don't really have anywhere else to put Cream in that particular arc, hence why she's there. So you have this power trio for the story that will hopefully offset the teenage boy mindset of EU girls and still tell a good story that moves things forward.
Yeah.
So it's a very intricate kind of puzzle put together thingy just to tell a story.
Yeah. Well, Bunny is also a licensed character too, so she has some recognition outside of the comics. So there is that factor a little bit. It's kind of minimal, I suppose, but you know, she's recognized. Some people know who she is. So I think that might help too.
We'll see.
Yeah. It would be really nice if we could get more interactions between characters who haven't had a lot of interactions with each other, but at this point, it's a difficult balancing act for you, so...
Yeah. I mean, in early drafts, I had Amy on the Bunny and Blaze story because Blaze and Amy have that history together.
Right.
But when I was drafting it out, their interactions ended up overshadowing Bunny's story, and it just made everything too cumbersome.
Mm.
With the way that Sally's story is built, it's more of the interaction of the group and how they're trying to help Nicole, which speaks toward the whole dynamic of the Freedom Fighters in a way.
Yeah.
It's just it's the best way to tell the stories and the characters and move things forward.
Mm-hmm. All right. And our last priority Q&A question comes from Samuel P. You've mentioned that you'd love to do a Shovel comic once. I was wondering what your approach would be in adapting Shovel Knight and what kind of original characters would you create for it?
With any kind of licensed book, it depends on what the licensor wants. But the pitch I would make would be a straight adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
And really keep any original stuff to a minimum. Because Shovel Knight as it is a fantastic light story.
Yeah.
It doesn't need a ton of embellishment.
No.
And the little hints that they have at deeper backstories or side stories or what have you, I would rather get Yacht Club's notes and expand on that than try to create something new. It doesn't really need an injection of original characters. It has its towns. It has its town folk. It has a clear goal. It has a fantastic cast
yeah. of
characters to pull from. So now if this were to be a long ongoing series, like something Sonic wise, then sure, we'll bring in some extra stuff to, you know, flesh things out. But as a simple adaptation, the first approach, mm-hmm. I do it fairly straight.
Yeah, and I was going to say, the cast of Shovel Knight is fairly extensive as it is. You'd bring in even more characters would be... You'd probably just get things a little out of hand. unless it were, like you said, a long ongoing, in which case you could introduce things a bit more slowly. But there's so much to work with that I don't think you'd have any trouble just working with what they have. I would love to see you make a pitch to Yacht Club. I don't know if they'd be up for it, but that would be really cool.
I mean, I would love to work with Yacht Club, period. I know they've got new games on the horizon, whatever they may be. I mm-hmm. would love to be involved with those. Just anything. They have proven themselves to be a fantastic company, and I would yeah. love to get on board with that.
Yep, they are absolutely great. I am very much looking forward to the final Shovel Knight expansion coming soon for the Nintendo Switch. All right, let's get into some of the regular Q&A. This first one comes from Uwahi. Do you know if the company you work for keeps in mind what characters you've created? Meaning, is it possible for Sonic Team to introduce a Razor or Capcom to introduce a Tempo that's totally unrelated to Archie's version, or would they avoid using that name?
With anything licensed, the licensor is... Okay, I don't know technically, legally, the full extent of what the licensors have in terms of the Sonic books or the Mega Man books. My understanding is, because it is a licensed book, anything that is produced is technically owned by the licensor. Don't take me, you know, 100% on that, because I'm no lawyer. I don't know, but that's my understanding. So to that end, they're free to do whatever they want.
Mm-hmm.
Like, case in point, if Sega was to make a game called Sonic Universe, for whatever reason, and they didn't want the comic called Sonic Universe because they would think that would cause confusion, we would have to change the name of the book. There's no middle ground. There's no room for debate. That's how it goes.
Right.
If the licensor says, do this, we do it.
Right.
Hence so why... if they were to create a Razor the Warthog, boom, it's there. It doesn't matter that we already have a Razor the Shark. It doesn't matter if they introduce space aliens when we already have space aliens, wizards when we already have wizards. The licensor comes first. The mm-hmm. comics are very small potatoes in terms of the overall franchise.
It doesn't matter if the localizers end up calling Amy Princess Sally.
Exactly.
Or anything like that. It's what they say goes. So, you know, if they'd rather call Sonic's World instead of Mobius, that's the licensor's thing. Yeah, that's how it is. That's all the inn can do. So they could technically just use the name Tempo and just come up with a different character with that same name. Or the character Quake Woman.
Or along the same lines, they could come up with a Quake Woman and, you know, take ideas
mm-hmm.
from the book and then do something completely different because it's theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, that's more distressing than the idea of not using it at all or using a name. But what are you going to do? That's just the way it is.
Or they could tell you that, no, you can't use that character concept that we didn't actually use in the game, but you can make a character that looks almost identical to that character and give them a different name, and they'll be okay with it.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. Yep. These things happen.
That's the joy of working with a licensed product.
Yeah.
And honestly, it is a joy in its own sick little way. It's
sure,
it's
sure.
kind of a logic puzzle. It's all right. I want to do this, but I can't because of this. How do we work around that?
You're playing Tetris with the comics. It's weird. You don't have the Tetris comic license yet.
Not yet.
Someone should do that. I mean, someone's making a movie, a trilogy of movies about Tetris. I don't know how it's going to work. I don't know what's going on. It'll all fall into place eventually. Yeah. I don't know, though. It might all come crashing down.
As long as there's a few good lines in it, I'll be entertained.
Yeah. We'll see if the building blocks are there at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
See how it stacks up against other films.
Yeah. All right, next question comes from Edward V. I was wondering if Hyperstate / Super Emeralds will make it into the post-SGW continuity, or is it redundant to your previous statement that infinity is infinity?
It's a question mark at this point. The official line is that the Super Emeralds and the Hyperstates are not canon. That's the official line. I really like Hypersonic, and I think the Super Emeralds are cool.
Mm-hmm.
So if I get the chance, that's, you know, we were talking about working around things.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll find that workaround, but it's not, you know, my top priority right now.
I do like how you've managed to kind of give characters that really probably shouldn't have super states, technically give them super states, but not really. I'm okay with that. Make a little tweak there, here and there. Yeah, it's fine. It's cool with me. Sega doesn't have to know.
Staying judiciously silent on that.
Sega don't have to know anything. They'll figure it out.
Maybe.
Maybe they just don't care. Anyway, our last question comes from Joggle Man. Sounds like a Mega Man boss, kind of.
What weapon would Joggle Man have?
Joggle Man. He would have a Joggo. Maybe he would have
a really Englishy version of juggle.
Maybe, yeah, that might be it. A juggle man, yeah.
Oh, and like you can run around and you pick up lesser enemies and you're like juggling them to create kind of a bubble shield, leaf shield type of thing.
Maybe, yeah.
And you can like throw them as projectiles.
Yeah, that might be kind of cool. Or maybe he's Joggo.
I like Juggle Man.
Maybe he's Joggo Man, like he jogs a lot, so he's got some really cool shoes. I don't know.
You can run over spikes?
That's probably it. That's probably it.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. If Eggman Nega is Eggman's descendant, does that mean Ella the Maid is Ivo's baby mama?
No. Oh. Maybe.
All right. And that's it. That's the questions.
It brings to mind, I think it was Sonic Heroes.
Uh-huh.
The Eggman's profile said that he was a feminist.
Yes.
And then years later, it was brought up that it was probably mistranslation and it should have been womanizer.
Which is about the
other end of the spectrum you can get.
Yeah.
Which brings so many questions about Dr. Nega into light, and it's like, you know what? We don't need to investigate that.
No.
We can leave that alone.
I see Eggman being more of a feminist than a than a womanizer.
I didn't see him as so much as a feminist as he just hates everybody.
He's an equal.
You're all equally beneath him.
Yeah, it's an equal opportunity villain.
He's just better than the rest of you.
Yeah, I don't think he cares. I don't think gender is of much concern to him. He will rule you regardless. Anyway.
Gender politics of Sonic the Hedgehog.
Yes. This is, yeah. That's what this episode's turned into now. It's weird. All right. We got anything else we need to touch on before we get out of here?
No, let's put this one to bed.
Yeah, this this episode's been interesting.
Before we wrap up the show, we're going to give a quick shout out to all the patrons over patreon.com/bumblecast that makes this show possible. Big thank you to Daniel H., Zephyr Flame, Demo, Deus Dizdin, John B, Sam Cybercat, Deus Miles, Mike B, Fancy Fool, Connell T, Daniel L, Samuel P, Justin G, Jennifer R, Candy, for now, Andrew F, John M, S. Yavardovich 9X, congratulations again on your win for the Bumble Raffle, Alex B, and James K. Yet again, thank you so very much, guys.
You are officially the best. Don't let anybody tell you otherwise.
Because they would be lying.
That's very true.
Kyle, if they want to find out more about you on the day-to-day basis, what can they go to? Where can they go to? What can they read?
They can head on over to kngi.org, where you can find archived episodes of this show and many others. I'm also on Twitter at KyleJCRB. And you can find me streaming live every Saturday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time over on 8bitx.com. And where can they find you, Sir Ian?
You can find my portfolio and all sorts of good stuff at bumbleking.com, or you can find me at Twitter at IanFlynnBKC. And be sure to come back around next week when we will have episode 3 of Bumblecast Gaming, where Kyle and I get back in that big rig and we go back on the road.
Yeah. Don't forget to go head on over to patreon.com/bumblecast, where you can read Ian's articles on and his reviews on the Nintendo Switch games that he played. Those are freely available to all, so everyone can read them. You don't have to be a patron, but if you have some, you have a little bit of spare change burning a hole in your pocket, you know, we'd appreciate it if you'd like.
So, we certainly won't say no.
No, of course not. So that's going to do it for this edition of the Bumblecast, I think, unless we got anything else we need to get to, Ian.
Nope, that's it. We'll see you next week for Bumblecast Gaming, and the week after that for Bumblecast Episode 37.
Game over! What the hell is going on with my phone? Oh, my phone's making noise. Ah, all these things. Just be quiet, Linkle. I don't need you. Silence my phone. Anyway, jeez, this show is falling apart. Oh, we got good outtake fodder for the end of the show. Anyway, let's carry on, shall we?
You want me to do the lead into the main topic, or do you?
Go ahead and do it.
All right.
It's your show. You do it. You know how stereo and mono works. Don't try to play coy with me. You know some things about technology, man. Come on.
Way back in the day, during the Sonic fan comic renaissance, Tyson Hess, back when he went by the handle Mechanical Penguin, and did stuff for Psychos. That's My Sonic stuff. He had a reoccurring character that was a ninja in all grays named Mono, and you assumed it was because he was monochrome. And then they introduced his evil twin brother, Stereo. And the one strip that I will never forget is a flashback sequence where they go meet their father, Dorobi Sarandosando, the most powerful ninja in all of Utah.
It took me a minute to get through that. Oh, that's great.
It's just... Oh, it was beautiful.
Reminds me of bass and treble. Yes, yes. Oh, that's awesome.
Hi there, and thanks for listening to the Bumblecast. If you liked our show, be sure to hit the subscribe button and consider supporting us on Patreon. We have some great rewards as well as big plans on how to make the show even better. Also, rate and review our show on iTunes. It gets more folks listening and helps us out, so we definitely appreciate it. Original music composed by Ken Coda Snyder, used with permission. Find more of his music at bc.s3m.us and find the theme song at noisechanradio.bandcamp.com, available as a pay what you want download.
I like cream. It goes well on cakes.